From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's forum in our opening hour, when it comes to bullying, popular students go after their social peers more than they do after so-called social misfits. That's according to a new study co-authored by a UC Davis sociologist, which also finds that high-status kids get harassed more frequently as they climb the social hierarchy. Is bullying reaching a crisis point in U.S. schools? We'll talk with experts about the latest research on bullying in schools and ask you about your experiences. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 1 in 3 adolescents report being bullied during the school year. Now a new study published yesterday in the American Sociological Review reveals that popular or high-status kids go after each other more than after kids who are traditionally picked on, the overweight, disabled, or LGBT. The study, conducted with over 4,000 9th and 10th grade students in 19 North Carolina, public schools, also reveals that the more popular students who experience being victimized or picked on actually suffer more than other students. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we focus on bullying and the study and what it means. Joining us in studio is Rick Phillips. He's Executive Director of Community Matters, a nonprofit based in Santa Rosa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Also, Susan Eva Porter, is with us in studio. She's Dean of Students at Branson High School and author of a book called Bully Nation, Why America's Approach to Childhood Aggression is Bad for Everyone. Welcome.
Thank you.
And with us by phone from UC Davis is the co-author of this study, Robert Ferris, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Davis and joins us from the UC Davis campus. Welcome, Robert Ferris.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin with you so we can get some outlines and parameters of this study. There is, I should mention, sort of a wonder about why North Carolina, first of all?
Well, that's a matter of really convenience. When I was in graduate school, I got involved in an ongoing study of these kids that had already been following them for a couple years, and I was able to add some questions about bullying to that. So it was an opportunistic choice.
Well, actually, some of the findings that you have correlate to those that were found in a rather elite school in New York, public school. But let's talk about what you found out here. I mean,
sure.
I kind of outlined it a little bit in the introduction, but the fact of the matter is we're talking about asking kids who was mean to them. In fact, you kind of avoided the word bullying, didn't you?
Yeah, that was intentional. Kids don't think about, particularly at the high school ages, tend not to use that term to describe what's going on. They'll use terms like drama or beef and so on.
Talking blank.
I was going to avoid that for the radio. But they use those kinds of terms to describe these things, and they don't think of it as bullying. And so we wanted to avoid that question. So we started with a very wide net and then asked kids to name who had been picking on them or had done something mean to them. And we told them to disregard anything that was sort of playful or harmless teasing. And then we followed that up with questions about how often it was occurring, whether it involved physical violence or verbal abuse or sort of what we call indirect aggression, which is, spreading rumors, gossip, shunning, those kinds of things, cyberbullying. It turns out that what they're talking about looks a whole lot like the academic understanding of bullying. So most of these relationships are occurring. Most of these sort of harassing relationships are they're experiencing the harassment weekly, and it involves multiple forms of aggression.
So, and often multiple being picked on. They're not necessarily unilateral kind of picking, right?
Right, right. So we often we'll see patterns of a number of kids in one case at least as many as 17 or 19 kids picking on one single student.
And the kids were, you followed this up with, in the springtime, asking them how this effect had stayed with them, and in many cases found anxiety or anger, depression, attachment to the school was affected, all of those things. And I guess what I'd like to find out here is how you provided the social map to that to come to the conclusion that you came to, which says that those kids who were higher up in the upper tiers or more popular are the ones who suffered more.
Sure. What we did was we asked the kids to name their five closest friends, and we're interviewing all the kids in the school, or nearly all of the kids in the school. And so from all those different friendship nominations, we can kind of create a social map of the school. It's a social network like you would see on Facebook. But in this case, it's really exclusively close friendships. And those diagrams tend to look kind of like bird's nests, with a very dense core and then an increasingly sparse periphery. And what we found was the kids, as kids approached that or were closer to that dense core, the kids who are the most popular, most connected to their peers, were increasingly being targeted by their peers and generally their rivals within their social circle. And then on the second part of the study, we looked at the consequences of victimization, and we found that we looked at five different outcomes: anger, anxiety, depression, attachment to school, and popularity. And we found that that for four out of those five outcomes, the higher the victim was in the social ladder, the more distressing the victimization was.
You also found, I believe, that there was competition for status being at the root of this whole nature of aggression. In other words, there are social rewards for bullying.
Yeah, that's some of my other research that was published last year. And we found there, in that case, we followed kids over a two-year period, and we found that, in fact, bullying can be effective. We think, this is a process of jockeying for social position, and a lot of the evidence supports that, including the finding that it does, in fact, work, provided they're targeting the right kinds of victims, which are basically their rivals, other high-status kids.
We're talking to Robert Ferris, associate professor of sociology and co-author with Diane Felmy of Penn State, with this new study about, finding the cool kids, so-called, get bullied too. But those kids that are at the top, like at the 4 or 5%, they not only obviously don't get bullied, but they don't do much bullying.
Right. What we found is an interesting parallel. A couple years ago, we published a paper that examined the same questions, except we were focused on trying to identify who in the social network is likely to be aggressive. And we found that as kids, aggression escalated as kids gained status up until roughly the 93rd, 94th percentile of status, and then it began to reverse. And we see the same finding. This is meant to be kind of a sequel paper to that, where we're looking at victimization and trying to identify who's being targeted. Because it could be the case that the strong are targeting the weak, but in fact we find higher rates of targeting among their rivals. But again, we see this reversal at the very top. So kids who are climbing the social ladder are facing a lot of harassment and antagonism, but the ones who make it to the very top rung tend to, in our data at least, to have arrived at a safe perch, kind of above the fray.
And those who suffer more, those popular kids higher up in the hierarchy who suffer more than, let's say, kids who are more apt to be picked on in the traditional sense, they have more to lose, I suppose, and they're not as used to being picked on. At least those would be my assumptions. I guess
yeah.
That came out in your study too, right?
I want to clarify that. We do see a second and more traditional pattern of kids who are vulnerable and perhaps lower on the totem pole being harassed at high rates. And we see that but we do find that these outcomes are more severe for higher status victims. And I think what's going on here is that the kids who are sort of would look like traditional victims of bullying have experienced merciless harassment and abuse often since elementary school. And so they already have relatively high levels of anxiety and depression. These are kids who are, in our data, who are physically underdeveloped, kids who are complete social isolates, who are absolute loners without any friends, and kids who have really poor body image. And so these are kids for whom a given incident of bullying, by the time they get to high school, is not going to be a radically transformative experience. It's probably going to do more to reinforce their sense of where they fit in. than to challenge it. And contrast that to a relatively high status kid who may have invested a whole lot in their social standing. These kids may feel like they have more to lose, and bullying and victimization may come as more of a shock to them.
And Robert Ferris, Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Davis and co-author of the study that we're talking about here this morning. And I want to bring in our two in-studio guests, Susan Eva Porter and Rick Phillips. Susan Eva Porter, pretty much conform with what you've observed?
Well, certainly, yes, absolutely. And I think the important thing about this study, I think there are two important things. And the first is to let us know that there's aggression going on at all levels of the social world. And so that's really important, because I think in the conversation we're having about childhood aggression, we are limiting it to the people we think of as traditional victims. But the other is what I see, and Robert didn't use this word, but those kids at the top have a lot less resilience socially. So surprisingly, because we think of generally the popular kids as the ones who have really developed this kind of resilience, and that's why they're popular. But in fact, I think the opposite is true in many cases.
They're more vulnerable, maybe.
Well, certainly they're more vulnerable in the way Robert's speaking. They've never had to take their licks. And so his study suggests that when they have to do it, the consequences are pretty severe for them, or pronounced. I think that's a better word, pronounced.
Some would argue maybe that's good for them in terms of learning what the adult world is like. I'm sure you've heard that argument.
Well, and I wouldn't disagree. I really wouldn't disagree in that. I think we all develop resilience in certain ways. And if you've been inoculated from the kind of routine social hardship that brings wisdom down the line, then I think it's not a bad experience to have. And it's not just a bad experience. It's inevitable for most of us.
I think you and Rick Phillips may be somewhat in disagreement about how mean kids are, and we'll talk about that. But I want to get your take just on the sense of what you've observed. I mean, the sense of particularly the internet in many people's minds has, if anything, exacerbated tremendously the kind of picking on and victimization that we see, because you can reach so many more people and do it so instantly.
Well, here's the analogy I use. So if we look at social media, I think it's as though we've put kids in a room with megaphones and we've left them unattended, and now we're getting really angry at them for being loud. And so social media amplifies what kids are doing, but it doesn't change the initial mistake they're making. And this is one of the things we have to tease apart when we're wanting to help and support kids on both sides of the dynamic. And so we are so angry at kids for what they're doing in social media, but they're not doing anything we didn't do. We just may have only been able to say it to one person or write it on one bathroom wall. Now, a Facebook wall can go to a million people, but that doesn't mean the child behind the post is a million times worse. But that's how we're responding.
Well, we're also responding with legislation. In fact, Assembly Bill 256, I believe it was, which was passed in California and signed by Governor Brown, it's pretty strict on bullying. A lot of people say, this is interfering with the First Amendment. This is too harsh. This is too alarmist. What do you say?
I would agree with that. And what I think is that it's not the best approach to help our kids in any way. So that what we're doing is we are coming down on kids for using this technology that we've created, we've given them. We're also not providing them with any education on how to use it. And this is where we're getting our anger out. Are kids getting hurt? Absolutely. And they need to be supported. But this isn't the way to do it.
And Susan Eva Porter, again, is Dean of Students at Branson High School, author of Bully Nation, Why America's Approach to Childhood Aggression is Bad for Everyone. Rick Phillips, Executive Director of Community Matters, a nonprofit which is based in Santa Rosa. Kids are meaner to you, Rick. They're more cruel. In fact, it's a mean culture out there with kids.
Yeah, I think young people are mirroring the behavior of adults. And we live in a world where popularity becomes associated with being sarcastic, putting people down, you get more points in school sometimes for being sharp-tongued and sarcastic than you do for being kind and compassionate. We often say that, and young people tell us, it's cooler to be cruel than it is to be kind in terms of establishing your social position in the hierarchy.
But in the top of the hierarchy, as Robert Ferris said, those kids don't necessarily have to be cruel, or you found that they are as well?
Well, I think they're also practicing that same level of, cruelty.
Absorbing it from the culture?
Absorbing it from the culture, the media, the don't snitch, don't tell, take pictures, pile on, is rewarded in the program Survivor. It's seen in the film Jackass. It's just part of the endemic into our culture. And so the broader question for me is how do we shift those social norms so we make it cooler to be respectful, compassionate, and kind, and not be a bystander and watch other people suffering?
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of your work has been focusing on bystanders. I mean, these kids who are just watching and letting it happen and not taking any action or not speaking up. Yeah.
In the more than 1,500 schools we serve at Community Matters, what we found is as many as 85% of the kids on any given day are not involved in the bullying relationship of being either the aggressor or the victim. That 85% of the kids are watching. And here's the important part. Silence is a form of consent. And when kids are quiet, they're saying, yes, you can do what you're doing, and there's no accountability.
They're giving approbation, in effect, almost.
Yes, very much so, Michael.
So what about the legislation, then, the California state legislation, from your perspective?
Well, I think it's seductive to think that we can both lock tragedy out of our school by having thicker glass and that we can legislate compassion or kindness. It feels good. It's like three strikes, you're out. It makes us feel good to have laws and policies and suspend kids when they do terrible things rather than correct and restore and make harm reparation part of what we do. So I'm a person that comes from the philosophy is we'll never legislate this problem away. We've got to educate people to be more compassionate and look out for each other. That's the best solution to changing the social dynamic of meanness.
And what about the semantic use of the word bully? I mean, to some extent, it's gone really haywire, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's. I think it's been diluted. And now you see 3- and 4-year-old kids running to their teacher at preschool or in kindergarten saying, he bullied me, and it might have been a mean word, a put down, an unkind gesture, or leaving somebody out on the playground, not letting him play on a swing. So I think we've got to reestablish our language and not use bullying as a catch-all term, but name things, because you can't stop what you can't see, Michael, and you can't tame what you can't name. So when we can give kids the vocabulary that leaving somebody out is unkind, that piling on with cruel words is malicious, when we educate people that those are the behaviors that are not acceptable, then we can challenge each other to be better.
Again, Rick Phillips is Executive Director of Community Matters, a nonprofit which is based in Santa Rosa. Let me go back to you on this, Robert Ferris. You avoided the word bully because of the way kids misinterpret it and they see it too narrowly and they don't necessarily even understand what it means. I think it has been so widely and promiscuously used that maybe that holds true for the rest of us as well. But the whole idea of victimization and of kids being pushed around and this meanness that we're talking about, cruelty and so forth, did you find that administrators were sometimes really, because this has been the indictment, blind to what was going on?
Oh, yeah. And I think that's completely true. And to some extent, I don't blame them. Kids are very, very subtle in the way they go about this. I don't blame teachers for not seeing the bullying that's going on. It's glances, it's text messages, it's occurring in bathrooms. They can't be everywhere. They're in the business of teaching, first and foremost. And, kids are, I think, monitoring is only one small part of the solution. You're getting adults to be, and administrators to be more aware of it is important, but it's not going to solve. You have to work with kids to stop the behavior first and foremost.
Well, Susan Eva Porter, if, as Rick Phillips says, this is so endemic in our culture and kids, it trickles down and kids just follow essentially what they're seeing in the media and everything, how does one go? And a lot of this is just natural aggression, outlets of aggression. Some of it quite mean, of course, but how can you re-educate them? How can you reprogram them? That's really, I think Rick Phillips is right, fundamental question.
Well, I think there's lots we can do, and Rick is doing a lot with his organization. I think the first thing we can do is have comprehensive social-emotional programs in place, which his is one of them. But I think also we've got to look at the other side of the equation, which is resilience. And we really aren't looking at that at all. But the first thing I would do, and if I did only one thing and wanted everybody to only do one thing, it would be stop using the labels. Because then we'd have to actually think much more creatively when kids came to us to describe what was going on or when we observed things. We'd have to think in terms that weren't black and white or unidirectional. So when we talk about bully and victim, we have created an entire scenario that is going from one child to another, and it's not a dynamic. And what we know about schools, those of us who work in schools, is that it's almost always a dynamic. And as soon as we lose that, we have abdicated our responsibility for really helping kids work through the kind of dynamics that they're going to have to deal with their whole lives. Doesn't mean we don't support them. Doesn't mean we don't give them care when they are in pain. That's not it at all. But we are using very simple language and simple concepts to deal with very, very complicated issues. And in doing so, we are losing, we're losing the battle.
So would you say the study maybe needed to take the dynamics into a greater extent, or that it's missing something along those lines?
No, I think I don't think there's anything wrong with the study at all. I think what's what I love about it is that it's broadening our view of where the aggression is. But it's also focusing let me tell you, the thing I love about self-report, so what they did in this study, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, but what they did is they asked kids to name kids who had been mean to them. Let me tell you, that would have been better than Christmas Day and my birthday rolled into one if I'd been in high school and somebody had asked me to name five mean kids, man. I think that would have been the best thing in the whole world.
Actually, I can think of kids saying, I'm not going to name somebody. That's tattling. That's snitching.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But what we're doing is we're setting up kids to target kids and to see kids as targets themselves. And so I think it's we're doing a lot by creating a frame that is evincing and evoking what we want to see. Now, I'm not – I think it's actually an important study. And but I think we've got to be careful how we frame things and careful how we speak about them, especially the labels.
Well, Rick Phillips, you were speaking before about really the importance of teaching compassion, kindness, empathy, all these kinds of things, which, you know, we all welcome and embrace. How do you teach those things, though? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of this bullying, as we're calling it, and maybe that's like the bossy word, it ought to be maybe retired, but a lot of it comes out of peer approval and peer sanctioning. And so you have to kind of change the whole calculus of what peers approve.
Exactly. I think you said it really well. The social dynamic that Sue was speaking about is at play here. If, as I said earlier, it's cooler to be cruel than it is to be kind, and we want to move that social needle away from that to more compassion, those are skills that have to be taught. But it starts with waking up the courage of people to understand that it's in their own self-interest to look out for each other. See, we'll never create a safe school or a safe community or a safe world if the majority of the people inside the community aren't interested in taking care of each other. And that isn't said altruistically. It's said very self-servingly.
Practically.
It's very practical. So we acknowledge that. And so we invite kids into the conversation and say, what if we could teach you some things that you could say or do that would help your friends be safer? That would keep the people you care about out of trouble. So we're inspiring them from self-interest. And what we found is the character development happens if we reach kids where they are, wake up their courage, give them some tools so they can intervene with their friends. And when they see success, each one teaching one, each one reaching one, we create social norm change over time.
I'm going to bring you, our listeners, into this. I know many of you have stories that you may want to tell. Just make them short, please, and cogent, but feel free to join us with any questions or comments. Our toll-free number is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786. You may want to relate some of your experiences, or if you have a question or comment, join us. Our toll-free number again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When it comes to bullying, popular students seem to go after their social peers more than so-called social misfits. That's according to a new study co-authored by UC Davis sociologist and a professor from Penn State. That sociologist is with us by phone this morning, Robert Ferris. Robert Ferris, just a quick question to you, and that is this term social misfits. I'm a little cringy with it. You know, I mean, it seems to Well, it makes me uncomfortable, to tell you the truth. Is there a better way of better language than social misfits?
I hope so. Actually, that's not a term that I use. We talk in our study about vulnerability, and I think there are kids in any given school who are going to be viewed as different, who have probably unintentionally violated some of the very ambiguous and unwritten rules of high school life. And, perhaps they're overweight, perhaps they express gender differently. There's many different reasons these kids get singled out, and they don't receive a lot of support from their peers. So, I don't want to use that term misfits, but I do think there are kids who are vulnerable and they get picked on, and we see that in our data as well as this popular dynamic.
And Susan Eva Porter, also with us, Dean of Students from Branson High School and author of Bully Nation, Why America's Approach to Childhood Aggression is Bad for Everyone, and Rick Phillips, who's Executive Director of Community Matters, a nonprofit based in Santa Rosa. Here's Joe Rick Phillips, who says, I believe your guest is somewhat out of touch when he says that silence is a sign of consent. For me, it is more of a sign of shyness and possibly fear.
Well, what I'm referring to, Joe, is if there's a troubling issue at school and people are surrounding something that's going on and somebody pushes or shoves somebody and nobody speaks, then the aggressor is reinforced to continue doing the mean-spirited behavior. So when we don't speak up, when we don't intervene, when we don't say or do something, when we see injustice or intolerance, we are complicit with the behavior. That's what I meant by silence as consent.
Another listener, Paul, who writes, how much of the studies examine bullying for sexual predation? I have heard of boys, and I suppose girls can do this too, who have been rebuffed by a girl, have his friends target the girl. For days or weeks, they will call her fat, stupid, ugly, etc., until her self-confidence has been destroyed. And then the rebuffed boy returns and is nice to her, and she is relieved by the positive attention and submits to whatever he asks. This pack attack can happen to isolated girls as well as some of the more attractive and more popular, too. Robert Ferris?
That is horrible. We see it's hard to detect in the kind of data we were collecting this sort of coordinated attack for these purposes. But unfortunately, it would not surprise me.
Well, here's another listener named Willow who writes, and Susan Eva Porter, you might want to comment on Willow's comments. Says, I went through this bullying scenario with my 17-year-old son last year when he was in 10th grade. My son did not tell me because he did not want to be a snitch. My son is in a private Waldorf school. At least 8 students and 5 parents knew that bullying was going on for a 5-month period, 1 to 3 incidents a day, 100 incidents is minimum, and no one came forward to inform me, his parent, the staff, or counselors at the school. This community in which I reside is very unhealthy mentally and emotionally that they would watch, hear, and know that a child is being abused and not do anything about it.
Well, if I were Willow, I would want to perhaps pull my kid out of that school if that was an accurate description. Certainly, as Rick said, when we see things going on, we have to speak. But one comment about from one of the listeners talking about being shy and reserved is that we all contribute in our own ways, but we're also expecting kids to view situations the way the quote-unquote victim is viewing it. And that is making a lot of assumptions, especially in younger kids. So when we call a 10-year-old a bystander, we are empowering that child. We are telling that child that they have to accurately view a situation, know which side they need to be on, and make some sort of intervention that's appropriate. Adults don't do that. And yet we're asking kids to do that, and we're labeling them when they don't.
Well, you also label them often as a snitch when they do. I mean, if they go
Absolutely.
To a higher authority. And that's also a really formidable barrier.
That's right. Kids don't want adults to know. Kids don't want adults to know.
Well, let me go to our callers. And we'll begin, Ian, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Just from an academic perspective, but then also I think from a, this concept of teaching compassion, I grew up in a relatively small elementary school, relatively small middle school, and then I was thrown into a very large high school. And so all of a sudden kind of got knocked down into that second tier where there was a lot of infighting, and I was entirely unprepared coming from a smaller environment where I was insulated from that type of experience. And I think that is, at least from a size perspective, kind of a common transition for people. And so preparing in advance of getting to those larger high schools where bullying is more prevalent, I think, is an important potential thing.
Yeah, you want to comment on that, Professor Ferris?
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry to hear about your experience. I actually had maybe not quite the same experience, but I experienced a lot of I moved when I was in fourth grade, and I experienced, as part of the school transition, definitely a sense of feeling left out and not sure where I was fitting in. And I think there are things that schools can do about this, and I would like to see schools foster and encourage a greater array of kind of interest-based activities so that kids can find a niche and make friends that will be lasting.
Let me thank the caller and go on to another caller. And Jennifer, that's you from Walnut Creek. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. It's kind of funny going after Ian because I have a 9-year-old who's in a very small school, and he's not as insulated as I would have thought he would be. He's having some really horrific, I don't want to say it's bullying because it is one of his friends, we're pretty certain, leaving him just horrible messages on his work when he returns. Really surprising language for kids that age, you know, saying that he's a piece of you know what and the F word and all of these things. And then someone took one of his books that he was working on and wrote just horrible things all over it. And they're actually changing their handwriting and very savvy for this age. But we're pretty certain it's one of his quote unquote friends. And it could be a jealousy thing or a friendship triangle thing. But there's a good chance we're not going to find out who it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm really proud of how he's handled it. He's been really resilient and he's just kept his head high and he's very clearly wants to maintain his friendship with these kids. And if we don't find out who it is, I'm curious, would it be helpful to maybe sit down as a group of parents, since we're pretty certain it's one of these kids, and just talk about it with the kids just in general? Or, I mean, you know, he's going to get away with it probably, but how do I communicate to my kid and these other kids, like, how that's not really helping anybody? And I don't know.
Well, Susan Eva Porter is nodding her head here as you're describing what you think might be the good tack here to take. Yeah.
Well, I think because you're in a small community, I think you've got access, you probably have pretty direct access to the teacher and to the other parents. And so I would say recruit the other adults. I think what's important when you do that is that you talk about the dynamic that's going on, because you don't know for sure who the other child is. What you want to do is recruit the parents to be on your side. And so staying away from the defaming language is helpful, to say, you know what, it seems like the kids here have some trouble and I'd like us to get together to figure out how we can support them through this. So your parent, your fellow parents are your allies.
And not necessarily. I mean, it occurs to me, I can remember incidents, for example, where people would find out who was victimizing. They go to the parents, and the parents would be very defending of the child. And they would say, not my child. In fact, they'd be, in many cases, completely obstreperous.
Well, sometimes that happens because you're going to a parent and saying, your child's a bully. And so, of course, they're defensive.
I know people have been diplomatic about it, though, and still.
Sure. Well, you can't. But I think that's a good place to start. And I think if you don't give them that credit to begin with, then you're not going to get anywhere. So start there. And but it sounds like your child is doing a great job, which is fantastic. And I would say keep propping him up for his ability to work this through. And also ask him how you can support him. He's 10. He'll be able to give you some tips.
It's also encouraging to hear you describe him as being resilient and showing character here. Rick Phillips, had something to add?
Yeah, I think one of the ways the schools can support this kind of involvement is more and more schools are turning to social emotional learning as part of the curriculum. And one of the ways that can show up is if teachers use more restorative circles where there's an opportunity, Michael, to bring that into a conversation of inquiry. In other words, if a child like she's describing her son as being victimized, doesn't know who it is, if it's brought into a conversation with the other kids where they can monitor each other and call each other up to higher good, often that creates the conditions where kids will start to look out for each other rather than keep them, you know, separate and make it victim and aggressors. Make it everybody's problem. It's a common problem. Let's talk about it together as a community.
Takes a village.
It takes a village.
Let me go to some emails here. I'm sorry, you want to say something?
Yeah, I just want to add to that point that I might also tell your child that this is a very common experience. In our data, we see that the majority of a large proportion of these kinds of interactions, the harassment, is going on within friendship groups.
I wanted to go to some of the emails here. Anne writes, thanks for this topic. I have to say that we bullied and were bullied in school, and that was 40 years ago. I can't help wondering if all the talk about bullying and being a victim helps to set up a victim mentality. I know that there are different levels, and I would never condone violent acts, but sometimes a comment might be better ignored. When my nephew was about 13, he had to get glasses. One of his schoolmates made a derogatory comment about how the glasses looked. He replied in a composed fashion, "It wasn't until I got glasses that I realized just how ugly looking you are." End of bullying. Another listener writes, I have a 5-year-old who has been diagnosed high-functioning autistic. More and more kids are getting this diagnosis. He probably can't recognize bullying, nor would he tell anyone if he did. Educating him on bullying is going to be a challenge. What should we do to protect these kids? Any thoughts from either of you?
Well, certainly partnership with the school. And I think when Rick is talking about what schools can do, he's outlining a program where you get all kids involved to be looking out for everyone. And so you want that social network to be broad and wide, and so that kids don't get left behind. And certainly kids who have the social-emotional challenges that a kid on the autistic spectrum has needs more of us looking out for that child. Absolutely.
And Ben writes online, so what are some actual solutions to bullying? Are there good types of bullying? I was a bully and was bullied. I think it's a natural part of growing up. Harassment is the problem. Is there a difference?
Yeah, there's a difference between harassment and bullying. And I can hear from your comments that it sounds like you found it to be a formative part of your character. And I think for some people it can be. That level of resilience is different in different people. The other thing is if people are targeted repetitively, if this becomes a pattern in a school where some of these kids are targeted frequently and ongoing, that's where I think you get that amplification of pain and suffering and then often a call back to revenge. So what we found out is bullying prevention programs that actually work have to be systemic and part of a school culture. Too many times we're looking for an add-on, a plug-in, a quick fix, an assembly, a silver bullet. This is a problem that's going to take a lot of courage and will. And the things that are working is when we've involved the children, because they're not just the solution or the problem. They're really the solution. So we've got to invest in seeing our kids not as consumers, but contributors. And then talk about how do we engage them in that process.
You also need leadership. I mean, yes. You know, you as a dean, principals, I mean, a lot falls on your shoulders, I think. Susan writes, as a psychologist, I've worked in this area for many years. I've worked with targets, parents, and classrooms. I strongly urge to not overlabel behaviors as bullying, but to acknowledge that a lot of behavior is bothersome and kids need strategies to deal with it. We have to be careful not to create a victim identity. There it is again. But she goes on to write, another powerful finding is that simply standing by someone who is being targeted can reduce bullying. It's not even necessary to confront the bully. In addition, we need well-trained and helpful yard supervisors who can guide kids in independent problem solving. Yes. There's an excellent curriculum, Steps to Respect, that gives kids tools and understanding. And Jeffra makes a thoughtful point. She says, if parents and educators want to change children, they might first think about changing themselves. Adults are dictating the larger culture of meanness via the media and through our everyday interactions. As adults, we have to practice kindness, respect, and responsibility, and model those things ourselves if we expect our children to change or practice those values themselves. What about the family role? This is a question from Anne Marie. Want to comment on that, Susan Eva Porter?
Well, first of all, I want to say that when we talk about bullying, all of us have aggression. And aggression isn't going anywhere. And we have to find ways to channel it productively. So that is really central.
Dodgeball is good, by the way.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, and, you know, our kids actually aren't moving enough in schools. They aren't. And we're getting very, very reactive, especially when boys get physical with one another. We have sanitized schools. The wonderful article in the Atlantic Monthly about playgrounds. We've sanitized their play area. We are observing them too much. They are too identified with adults, not identified enough with going out and being on their own and taking appropriate risks. So we've reduced the risks they can take, and it doesn't surprise me at all that that aggression in the form of an eye roll or whatever it is going to be the most powerful thing they can do, and so they're going to keep doing it. We've got to find ways to get ourselves acknowledging that this is something that's part of us, but let's get kids moving too so that they, you know, don't have to take it out on each other.
And we'll bring more of our callers in. Let me go to you, Amy, in Oakland. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So glad to be here with you guys in this conversation. I help parents what I call bully-proof their kids, and I have also been teaching anti-bullying in elementary schools for about 10 years through a program called Soul Shop. And I wanted to just talk about their reactiveness. Like, one of the things I appreciate that Susan's mentioning is this complexity of this problem. Like, when you ask a child not to be a bystander, sometimes, especially in elementary, they're not capable of saying something in that moment because they're scared and their brain has shut down a little bit. And so they get into this freeze mode, or even some of the fights that they have are actually brain reactions, right? They're taking in the tension and the overwhelm from their home life and they're spitting it back on other kids. We call that leaking your balloon, right? Like, their balloon is full and then they're spitting it out on other kids. And even Brené Brown is doing all this research about this, is talking about how the tool of shame is our primary discipline tool, right? Well, when a child is shamed, that goes into a particular part of their brain, and they reflect it back to their other kids by shaming them in the same way. And so there's a place where it's like the leadership aspect of stepping in and modeling calmness and respect and curiosity when a child is bullying or teasing and helping them see what's really underneath it. I mean, I've come across countless situations with children where one kid has accused another kid, and when I really get into what's happening, that other kid is getting bullied at home or has an older brother that never lets him be in charge, and so he bosses other kids around. You know, like, there's a whole set of complex dynamics that if we were starting to address those emotionally, like our program Soul Shop, we actually go into schools and we do assemblies, but we hold the kids emotionally to talk about what's really going on. And once you start to talk about what's happening in their homes, compassion is a natural side effect because they're all going through so many of the same things.
Well, thank you for those comments, Amy, and I appreciate your call. In fact, sort of dovetailing on it, I'm looking at a Facebook comment from a listener named Michelle who says, I think the blame for this culture of bullying lies directly on parents. Parents who don't teach kindness and compassion are neglecting the major duty of raising good human beings. Let me get another caller on, and that's Shanta. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad that you're having this topic, and I wanted to bring up on the subject of teaching compassion and teaching empathy. There are all kinds of teachers out there who are really good at it, and they're preschool teachers. And we've been having such an emphasis on, you know, with President Obama trying to get more kids in preschool education. We have this big public discussion about it. But every time there is a discussion, people are talking about children preparing for kindergarten in an academic way, learning their ABCs, learning their numbers, learning their colors. But the most important thing that preschool-age children need to learn is exactly this, is socialization with other kids. How do you resolve conflicts? How do you express your feelings when you have not been treated well? And it's something that I think we really need to discuss. I mean, absolutely, these programs in high school need to happen. But people have so much of an emphasis in preschool on learning academics that I think this is going by the wayside, and this is the way to get our future children to take care of each other, is they have to learn it when they're four.
Well, Shanta, I think you make an important point. In fact, Rick Phillips, starting the earlier the better, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think we've got to introduce the conversation at the elementary stages as well as what's been said here in preschool. Children can be educated and taught, and it happens through modeling. I think one of the things that I'm encouraged about, Michael, is schools are beginning to understand that focusing on relationships and climate and social-emotional learning is not a soft, touchy-feely behavior anymore. It's actually a strategy to get better educational outcomes. If kids don't feel safe at school, if they don't have a peer affiliate group of friends, if they don't have adults they can trust, they're not able to lean in and learn. So we're beginning to kind of come together and coalesce that we've got to create a culture in a school that's more like a community and less like an institution, and that requires teaching kids impulse control, managing your emotions, getting along with people who are different, resolving conflicts peacefully, breathing when you're under stress. These are things that can be taught and learned, and we've got to begin to introduce them at the elementary level.
Well, it's very useful to hear you talk about these tools in the way you do, because I think about John Vasconcellos, a former assemblyman who took a lot of heat and was made fun of, even ridiculed in Doonesbury, talking about kids' self-esteem. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that a lot of this has to do with the importance of elevating self-esteem, not to ridiculous extremes, obviously, not saying, you know, every kid is great and all that kind of nonsense, but just being mindful of it, if nothing else. You going to say something, Susan?
Yeah, I would like to say I think putting self-esteem at the center is actually the wrong approach. Self-esteem is a byproduct.
I wasn't saying putting it at the center, by the way. I'm just saying part of the toolkit.
Sure, absolutely. But I think we err on the side of some people thinking that it should be at the center. And I think we should think of it as a byproduct of effectively utilizing the skills Rick is talking about and developing resilience. And when you have those things, when you can practice the skills, you've got self-esteem. So it's not enough to tell a kid they're great. You've got to teach them how to practice. Then they do it, they feel good about themselves, and then they feel good.
Nothing endures like character. That's not original Krasny. That's actually Scott Fitzgerald. Here's an online comment, and I'd like to go to you on this, Robert Ferris. Jason writes, I hate to be the guy who brings race into the discussion, but I wanted to see how it and racial diversity or lack thereof figured into this discussion. Growing up, all but my high school were pretty racially diverse, 50% white, 50% everything else. High school, 75% black, 25% other, 1% white, 24% other, 1% white. Anyway, he said, I noticed the more non-white the school, the less bullying or type of social bullying they're all talking about on the program occurred. Now, you were in North Carolina, and I was thinking you got a pretty southern culture down there. How white was it?
Well, our data, if you look at the whole data set, it's maybe like 55% white, 35% African American, and maybe 5 or 6% Latino. But that varied widely across districts. We had one district that was predominantly African American. I think roughly 60%.
Well, was there less bullying with kids of color? Or?
We didn't find large differences in the average rate of bullying. But one of the interesting dynamics that I'm going to be exploring in future research is that we found, contrary to some expectations, we found that actually bullying did not cross racial lines to a great degree. And even, you know, we already know the most high schools in America that are diverse are relatively segregated in terms of social relationships. So kids tend to be friends with kids who of their own racial or ethnic background. But even holding that constant, this tendency to associate with kids who look like you, we found even then a lot less interracial bullying than intra-racial bullying.
Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go to Solomon. Good morning, Solomon.
Good morning. I have a question for the panel. That my daughter, who attends the Oakland Public School a couple months ago, was in a lot of pain. Her finger, she said, was hurting. So we took her to Kaiser, and they told us that someone had to squeeze her hand very, very strongly, someone stronger than her, for the pain to be like that. So anyway, then she told us that it was one of the kids who did this to her. So we went to the school, the principal, and then there's a disciplinary person who said, I have talked to the other child, and she apologized, everything is okay. And your story is corroborated. That's it. I said, well, you know, he didn't want to talk to my child. I said, why not? He said, I've heard everything from you. I don't need to talk to your child. I said, she is the one who goes to the school. She needs to learn how to deal with this in the future if it ever happens again. She needs to know the tools, where to go, how to deal with this. And his answer was, it's not that bad. And imagine you telling the parent that whatever happened was not that bad. Fortunately, her finger wasn't broken, but it was enough damage for her to be in pain for a while. And, you know, the other thing is that as long as he talked to the other child and apologized, everything was okay. But they don't have the structure. And I ask, what's the procedure? And how do the school deal with this type of stuff? Is there any written how-to book? Is there any way that you could teach these children how to deal with this type of stuff?
Let me go to Susan Porter on this, and thank you, Solomon, for that.
Well, first, Solomon, I want to say I'm sorry that your daughter went through that. And then I'd actually like to pass it over to Rick, because he's got the exact kind of program that the school needs.
Well, when I was listening to Solomon's story, like anyone else here, it's hard not to empathize that the struggle he had as a parent to walk into a school, try to advocate for his child to get some resolution, and felt that the adult said, well, it's all taken care of. And again, I think what's missing here and what Solomon was referring to was creating a place where kids can talk with each other, you know, and a safe place where a dialogue can happen between a perpetrator and a victim, or a perceived miscommunication can be resolved. In other words, rather than adults fixing it, we've got to put more power into the hands of kids to become more self-reliant and capable of resolving their own problems. They need to learn the skills and competence. And that's one of the things we do with the program I mentioned called Safe School Ambassadors, is train kids, give them the tools of intervention and empathic communication so that they can help resolve these problems before adult has to become the authority figure to make it better.
I also like what you're saying in a larger context. There's been a lot of work in penitentiaries and in all kinds of penal institutions with bringing predators and victims together and actually having the victims describe what they went through and trying to build empathy in that way. This can actually be proven to be, on some instances, a fairly effective tool. We have run out of time, unfortunately, but this has been an illuminating and enlightening conversation. I want to thank all of our guests and thank you, our listeners, and remind you that you can also continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Robert Ferris, thanks for joining us. Can they read your study online?
Yes, they can. The ASA, American Sociological Association, which is at asanet.org, should have a copy on their website.
And you can find the link, actually, on our website, kqed.org. Thank you, Robert Ferris, again, Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Davis. Thanks to Susan Eva Porter, Dean of Students at Branson High School. Her book is called Bully Nation. And thanks to Rick Phillips, Executive Director of Community Matters. And thanks again to you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thank you for listening. Another hour up ahead, we're going to talk to Ben Tarnoff about the Bohemians, Mark Twain and Bret Hart, and San Francisco right after the Gold Rush and right after the Civil War. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.